I'm the operator with my pocket calculator.
Welcome once again to Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community here on WCOM LP Chapel Hill in Carrboro. This is Ernie Hood. I am a freelance science writer, and each week here on the program, we bring you cutting-edge information about what's going on in science here in the Triangle area, one of the world's leading hubs of scientific research and development. You can email us at radioinvivo@earthlink.net, and you can access a full archive of all of our hundreds of past programs at radioinvivo.net. The Burroughs Welcome Fund is a Golden Voices underwriter here on WCOM and Radio In Vivo. The Burroughs Welcome Fund supports excellence in science education across North Carolina. The fund believes that providing students with engaging and interactive curriculum helps to spark curiosity for careers in science, mathematics, and technology. You can learn about education grant opportunities for North Carolina schools and teachers at www.bwfund.org. Radio In Vivo is underwritten by the National Evolutionary Synthesis Center in Durham. NESENT is a nonprofit science center dedicated to cross-disciplinary research in evolution. NESENT is a collaborative effort of Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and North Carolina State University, and is sponsored by the National Science Foundation. Radio In Vivo is also underwritten by the North Carolina Association for Biomedical Research. Since it was founded in 1989, NCABR's mission has been to promote public understanding of and support for bioscience research and careers. NCABR offers many resources for both researchers and K-12 science teachers, including conferences and free professional development workshops. To learn more, visit ncabr.org. WCOM and Radio In Vivo thank this terrific group of underwriters for their support. Well, although there is still a long way to go, it cannot be denied that there has recently been remarkable progress in our understanding of cancer. As genetics, genomics, molecular biology, and bioinformatics have made tremendous strides in recent years, they have contributed to a much more sophisticated view of the many forms of cancer. Research on breast cancer has been at the vanguard of that progress, and today on Radio In Vivo, we are proud to welcome one of the scientists at the forefront of those efforts, who is helping to usher in a new era of diagnosis and treatment of the disease. Dr. Charles Perreault holds the May Goldman Shaw Distinguished Professorship of Molecular Oncology Research at UNC Chapel Hill. He is a member of the Leinberger Comprehensive Cancer Center, the Carolina Center for Genome Sciences, and he is the scientific director of the UNC Genomics and Bioinformatics Core Facility. He is also professor of genetics and pathology and laboratory medicine at the UNC School of Medicine. He received his PhD from the University of Utah in 1996 and performed his postdoctoral training at Stanford University. Chuck's lab at UNC is focused on using genomics, genetics, and animal models to decipher the underlying biology of the molecular subtypes of breast cancer, and then using that biological information to develop therapies that are specifically targeted against each of these distinct subtypes of breast cancer. Chuck, welcome to Radio In Vivo.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to start our conversation with the most recent major achievement by you and some 347 of your colleagues and your closest personal friends, no doubt, the September 23rd publication in Nature, called Comprehensive Molecular Portraits of Human Breast Tumors. This landmark study was the first really comprehensive genetic analysis of breast cancer. So would you, to get us started, kind of briefly describe the paper for us? And then I'd like to step back and learn more generally about the Cancer Genome Atlas project, which this was part of.
So the Cancer Genome Atlas takes a unique approach and first of all brings together many different universities, each of which had a different expertise. And this comprehensive approach that we did was to use multiple different genomic and genetic and actually protein technologies, all applied to a common set of about 700 different or 800 different breast cancers. So these different technologies included DNA sequencing, so we could identify all the mutant genes, a DNA copy number platform, so that we could identify which regions of the genome were amplified or deleted. We did gene expression profiling, which was the technology performed at UNC under my guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also did tests for other types of modifications of DNA called DNA methylation. We also looked at a special class of genes called microRNAs. And then we also had data for about 200 different proteins. So most papers in the past usually did one or two of these technologies. But because of this large sponsorship from the NIH, we were able to do all six of these on a common set of samples, thus allowing us to compare and contrast across the different technologies. And that really gave us particular insight and detail like we've never seen before.
That's very exciting. So tell us a little bit about some of the major findings regarding the subtypes of breast cancer.
So my work over the past decade and the work of others has shown that breast cancer is not one disease, but it's at least four or five different diseases. And this new work very much reaffirmed this finding. And it pretty much affirmed it on almost every one of these technologies that we looked at. So, you know, we knew about breast cancer being four groups, but I think the real advances from this paper were now we could find, in essence, the genetic causes of each of these groups.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, suggesting that these groups really are true different groups. But importantly, from the therapeutic perspective, now that we have potential causes of each group, this now should tell us where to put our therapeutic bullet at, right? Now, you know, the good news is some of these genetic causes are likely targetable, but some of them are not. And we have to figure out how these genetic causes affect what we call the pathways. And then once we understand how the pathways are affected, maybe we can do some other therapeutic interventions.
I see. So I understand that this also shed light, new light, on how to apply some of the existing drugs approved for cancers in other parts of the body, and new ideas for more precise targeted treatments going for those specific genetic alterations that you identified.
Right. So let me give you a couple, you know, concrete examples here. So one of the subtypes of breast tumors that we studied in this paper, which we call the basal-like subtype and others call triple-negative breast cancers because these tumors lack the three biomarkers that are scored for in the pathology clinic and which dictate if you get specific drugs or not.
Mm-hmm.
So these triple negatives are missing these markers, so these patients are left with pretty much chemotherapy options only.
And that's a pretty aggressive form.
It's a pretty aggressive therapy. The good news is for many of these triple negative patients, it's effective. For many, it's not.
Mm-hmm.
But what we could see was that these triple negative or basal-like patients, again, were completely different than all the other breast cancer patients in terms of the genetics causes of the disease. But somewhat surprisingly, what we saw was these basal-likes are quite similar to ovarian cancers. So about a year ago, the Cancer Genome Atlas, again, as a group, did a similar study on ovarian cancer. And so as we go through time and we have these different data sets of different cancer types, we can now start to compare across the types.
Sure.
And find, make findings that sort of transcend one disease and might be applicable to a couple diseases. So again, there was stunning similarities between basal-like breast cancer and ovarian cancer, which we already somewhat knew about. The hint that there was a commonality before because of specific genes, BRCA1 and 2, which are known breast and ovarian cancer susceptibility genes.
Mm-hmm.
But now it clearly extends beyond those two genes to include a handful of other important genes. And then the suggestion is that some therapies that are being used for ovarian cancer patients might be relevant for basal-like patients and vice versa.
And I understand that that particular finding is evolving into potentially a clinical trial.
There are some potential clinical trials for that, which is basically the chemotherapy regimen used for ovarian cancer is somewhat different than the one used for basal-like cancer. And so maybe we should try the ovarian cancer one on the basal-like one, and there are some clinical studies of that simple test in the planning phase. And actually, one of the studies that we already have ongoing in a clinical trial cooperative group that I'm a member of called the Alliance is already evaluating one of these drugs, which is pretty much has been used widely for ovarian cancer and is not used widely in breast cancer. So hopefully we'll have that answer in the next year or two.
That'll be interesting to keep an eye on. And I know that's not an uncommon occurrence these days, there is a lot of crosstalk,
yes,
among the different types of cancers. So it's very interesting, and I'm sure that your study is going to be seen as a landmark in that process. Chuck, as I mentioned earlier, I'd like to take a step back and get a little more description from you about the Cancer Genome Atlas project itself. Could you give us a kind of a thumbnail sketch of what is really this massive scientific undertaking?
Well, certainly. So this is a project, it must have started 5 or 6 years ago with what we call a pilot phase to sort of test the feasibility of this approach, and now it's into the main phase. But the basic 10,000-foot view is we wanted to apply all our best technologies to a common set of tumors to amass this more complete picture of the cancer genome than any one technology could do.
Mm-hmm.
But also to apply these technologies using the most talented institutions in the world, right, and in the United States, right? And so, for UNC, we have expertise in what's called gene expression profiling, and we're the gene expression site. But then we also brought in a number of the genome centers in the United States, like the Broad Institute and the Washington University in St. Louis, who are, the premier genome sequencing centers. The NIH brought together these multiple institutions. Each then performs the approach that they're skilled at.
Sure.
And then there are additional institutions with bioinformatics expertise that are brought into the mix, as well as UNC.
So the data crunchers.
The data crunchers, right? So we're absolutely a data cruncher site as well. And that's, that's the fun part,
mm-hmm,
right? And that's where the real discoveries are made, right? And, I've been trained as a wet bench experimental biologist, but now we're doing experiments in the computer, right? And we've created these gigantic data sets for which we will literally be doing analyses for the next 5 years, right? We'll probably be discovering things on the data that was published in this paper 3 years from now that we didn't even mention in the paper, because it's so rich and there's so many ways to look at it. So.
Sure. Well, tell us a little bit about some of the really cutting edge technologies that have enabled this project to even happen, because there's been, as I understand it, there's been this tremendous acceleration in the technologies and methodologies.
Well, the main leap forward technology is what we call, next generation sequencing, which is probably better called current generation sequencing
now
because it is the current technology now. But this was, you know, a quantum leap forward in our ability to sequence DNA, mm-hmm. or to sequence, you know, RNA, right, which allows us to do gene expression analysis.
Sure.
And you know, we can now, you know, do in a day or 2 days, which took years of work to do, right? So we can sequence a human genome in a week, mm-hmm. right? Whereas 10 years ago, when they first sequenced the human genome, it took 400 people 3 years to do it, and $3 billion
yeah,
to do
billions
it, right?
of dollars.
Right, and now it's, you know, yeah. and now it's, you know, $10,000 or something like that. It's
and,
just it's
and
just
approaching that magic $1,000
approaching
mark.
The magic $1,000 mark. It's just astounding, right? So we can, you know, and this was really the enabling technology for this approach.
So you're like a kid in a infinite candy store.
Oh, it's amazing, right? This is like the greatest time to be a geneticist because the tools are so powerful.
Indeed. So is this, Chuck, where the Human Genome Project really truly starts bearing fruit and giving us really solid, useful information to improve human health?
Absolutely, right? Because now, instead of, you know, you sequence one person, and it was helpful to have that reference genome, because mm-hmm. now you could identify all the genes, you had a look at each of the regulatory regions. But in disease, the genome goes awry in specific ways. And so what you need to do is to sequence hundreds of people or thousands of people. And that technology is enabling that. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what we're doing. And now we can see how the genome goes awry repeatedly for different diseases, right? And so for the Cancer Genome Atlas, we're targeting the 15 to 20 most common cancers and just plowing through each one at a time, and getting this, what we call the parts list, right, for each of the cancer types. And what you can see is that some of the parts are the same across different tumors. Some are unique to each tumor. But from this comprehensive and genome-wide approach, you know, in some ways, you can see the entire playing field now. Doesn't mean we understand it.
Sure.
Right? But at least we're looking at it all now. And that's really setting the stage for, I think, the real impact, which is now we're going to do these approaches on patients in the most modern clinical trials, right, where new therapies are being tested and the standard of care is being improved.
That is tremendously exciting, yeah. And I'm sure the next 5 years are going to be just a plethora of new developments and new ideas.
Probably so many. It's gonna, you know, stress the healthcare system and mm-hmm. and the clinical trial system, because there's so many opportunities.
Sure.
That it's at time it's hard to focus, but we will remain focused, right? And I think make significant advancements.
Well, let's return to this paper that we've been discussing about the breast cancer subtypes. Which, of course, is something that you and your group have been working on for many years now. What does this development and this new understanding mean for example, breast cancer diagnosis?
Well, it means the diagnoses will become more precise. So mm-hmm. instead of saying, well, you have a ER-positive breast cancer, we'll say, you have a luminal ER-positive breast cancer that also has genetic mutation A, B, and C. And I mean, we can say that today. What will happen as we actually perform some of these clinical trials to evaluate these new markers, we'll say, well, you have mutation A and B, and that means you're going to get this new drug X. And so it's this next phase where we start to partner the new genetic findings with the new drugs to make the diagnosis more precise, but that also goes hand in hand with the drug recommendations for patients of that particular biology type.
Sure. So will that development also have implications for early treatment?
So I guess, you know, early treatment in terms of prevention or the treatments when they get when they first walk in the door with the disease?
Both.
It is probably both, right? So if we talk about the prevention side, mm-hmm. right? Now that we know some of the genetic causes, some of the preventative strategies can be focused on those causes. And some of them might be new, and drugs are being developed against some of those causes. So the prevention studies will take a while to mature.
Sure.
Right. From the therapeutic side, there is, of course, a lag between the discovery and the clinical implementation or the clinical implications of the discovery,
mm-hmm.
right? So now that we've made the discoveries, we need to move into what's literally called the translation phase, right? I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about, you know, translational studies. Well, this is what it means, right? You have to take the discovery, put it into a clinical setting where you objectively evaluate whether the new discovery makes a difference about the outcomes for the patient or whether they might respond or not to the drug. You know, that testing takes years.
Sure.
And then I have great confidence that some of these new discoveries will pass that hurdle, right? And then what we will have is a new biomarker or a new clinical diagnostic and a new drug that goes with it. And what's likely to happen is that over the years, there'll be a few more of these, hopefully each year. And in that way, we get closer to attacking the biology of that person as opposed to attacking the biology of all breast cancer, right?
Sure.
Which is a very imprecise definition.
Mm-hmm. Right? So really where it's going is straight towards personalized medicine.
Yes. I mean, we keep you know, making more and more bins. I don't know if we'll ever get to the day where, you know, you take 100 patients and they'll get 100 different treatments, right? I think what's more likely is we'll take 100 different patients, we'll see that they basically have 10 diseases,
mm-hmm.
and each of the 10 will have a specific treatment, right? So, and that's a great improvement, right? Because we're getting closer and closer to the biology.
Absolutely.
But, you know, one of the take homes from our paper was that, you know, breast cancer is not one disease, it's four diseases, but it's also not 400, right?
Sure.
So mm-hmm. we don't need 400 different treatments. In very general terms, we need four or five. And if we could effectively do that, that would really be a great advancement.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chuck, you're quoted as saying that in some cases, the genetic aberrations that you characterized were so strongly associated with one or the other luminal subtype that they could be considered causal.
Right.
Now, I know that that is a word that folks like you only use with a great deal of caution. So I found it striking that you were willing to go out on that particular limb. You called the finding stunning. Tell us more about that, because it's very interesting.
I'll give you the data, and you can make your own interpretation, right?
Okay.
So for this, what we call the luminal A subtype, which is the most common subtype of breast cancer, it's probably 40% of breast cancer patients have this phenotype.
Mm-hmm.
What we saw were for two particular genes, not only was the mutation of that gene associated with that subtype, but a certain type of mutation in that gene was associated with that subtype. And I'll just give you one example, because this is a gene that many people are intensely studying because it's a drug target.
Okay.
So it's got a, you know, forgive the jargon, right? It's got a terrible name called PI3 kinase, right?
Okay.
It is a gene which sends a growth in promoting signal, right? And actually, you get mutations in the gene, and it turns it on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always sending a growth signal, even if it shouldn't.
Thus a tumor,
right? And you get multiple types of mutations in this gene, but actually, it also has what are called hotspot mutations, where different people get the exact same mutation. And in the TCGA, we had, out of 500 patients, there were 27 patients who had a particular mutation, right, which was a known activating hotspot mutation. Mm-hmm. Of those 27, 25 were of the luminal A subtype.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And there was one in another of the groups and one in another, right? So 25 of 27 really suggests, right, if yeah. this happens, you're that.
The data
right?
don't get no better than that.
Well, we had another mutation in a different gene that had another hotspot mutation. Mm-hmm. 13 of 13 had the luminal A subtype. So there were a number of these associations of, you know, again, it's like, the specific mutation with this phenotype suggests it's causative. Sure. I don't know how else to interpret that.
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think that's what people are looking to this right? type of research to hear.
And this is not uncommon, right? There are mm-hmm. other diseases where we see very frequent hotspot mutations. For example, in melanoma, there is a specific one base mutation in one gene, and about half of melanoma patients have this.
Mm-hmm.
And now a pharmaceutical company has made a drug against that actual mutant protein, which is, I mean, that's extremely personalized medicine, right?
Right.
And there are other examples of this as well, right? So, you know, in part, I say these are causative based upon findings from these other studies and other cancer types where you see these highly recurrent mutations with one disease type. We'll now go do the genetic experiment where we make the mouse that has that mutation, and we'll see if it gets a similar phenotype of tumor as it's human, as was seen in humans.
Now, these type of genetic aberrations or mutations that appear to be causal, what is the role, and I guess the wider question here is what is the role of the environment and environmental exposures in, you know, getting the disease going? Is it pulling the trigger, as it were, or are these so causative that environment is secondary, and you're going to, if you have this, you're
well,
going to get the disease?
You know, the possible environmental causes of breast cancer is a long story and one
indeed.
that I don't work on too much.
Sure.
And it's, and I can say it's something we don't understand well. But we know there's an influence of the environment, right? And
mm-hmm.
and there's an influence of what I'll call the individual's life history, right? Some, you know,
sure.
What are the diseases they've had? Have they had certain viral or bacterial infections? You know, we don't know if there's any involvement of virus or bacteria in breast cancer.
Or even in utero exposures.
Or either in utero exposures. There's all kinds.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's, you know, it's plausible to suggest some of these environmental exposures may induce mutations, random mutations in the genome.
Mm-hmm.
And if you happen to get a random mutation in one of these genes that causes a specific breast cancer subtype, then now that random mutation isn't so random and has caused your tumor,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think anything that might generally increase the mutation frequency would just generally make you more likely to get cancer. And then if it happens to hit one of these specific genes and one of these specific locations, then boom, maybe it's caused your breast cancer or it's caused your melanoma.
Sure. So going forward, as we approach the $1,000 genome that everyone is targeting and more personalized medicine where, you know, in 10 years you may have a credit card with your genome
mm-hmm.
on it to take to the clinic with you, will the precise information about the individual's genetic genome, really, and mutations, do you think that information will be sufficient to explain some of these diseases, at least in some cases?
It'll explain more. Whether it'll provide the complete story, it won't comply the complete story because there's still complex protein interactions and ongoing environmental and microenvironmental effects. Mm-hmm. But
epigenetic effects.
Epigenetic effects, mm-hmm. right? Sure. But of course, it will explain more and hopefully a lot more, right? I think for cancer patients, we absolutely want to look at your cancer genome to find these cancer-causing mutations. We also, in an idealized world, would like to look at your normal genome, right? Because that will tell us something about how your body metabolizes drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And that may say which drugs you should get or this drug might be ineffective. Or it might say, well, we shouldn't give you this dose because you're a fast metabolizer, so we need to give you more, or you're a slow metabolizer, so we need to give you less. So studying your normal genome and your cancer genome are complementary, and we want and both will be important, and both will be improvements upon the way it's currently done.
Absolutely. So it will all work together.
It will all work together. The challenge is to not get drowned in information, right? When you collect genome-wide information, you get so much information that a lot of it is not clinically useful,
mm-hmm.
right? So part of the challenge is to figure out what actually helps doctors make decisions, and what is, important information, but won't change how the physician does their job, right? And so that's another challenge of this information flood that we're experiencing.
My guest on Radio In Vivo today is Dr. Charles Perreault from UNC, and we are exploring his very exciting work on increasing our understanding of breast cancer. Chuck, tell us a little bit about the findings in the study that related to breast cancer-related disparities. I understand that it's been well documented that there can be dramatically different outcomes in different breast cancer subtypes in different populations.
So this particular TCGA study didn't focus too much on the disparity outcomes, but a great deal of past work that myself and others at UNC have done has.
Okay.
And much of this is based upon the Carolina Breast Cancer Study that's been a decades-long study going on here at UNC, which is a population-based study of breast cancer patients sampling or oversampling for young women with breast cancer and African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found from this study was that one of our subtypes, this basal-like subtype, or the triple-negative cancers, tends to be more frequent in young women versus older women, and more frequent in African-Americans versus Caucasians. And at the same time, young women and or African-Americans get more basal-like cancers, they get fewer of the luminal A cancers, which have a better outcome.
Mm-hmm.
And so right off the bat, you can sort of see if you get more of an aggressive type of cancer, then overall your outcomes will likely not be as good.
Sure.
And so that finding in and of itself can explain some of the racial outcome disparity differences that we see with age and race.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're trying to get at why we see this frequency difference between these groups. And again, some of the Carolina Breast Cancer Study has shown that there are some what I will call life history features that modulate that. And there are also some genetic features that can affect that. So as always, it's both the environment and the genetics that are contributing to these differences.
Absolutely. Well, Chuck, kind of widening our focus a little bit, I wanted to ask you, and you've already touched on some of this, but I want to get your take on it maybe from another perspective. What are the challenges involved in translating this incredible treasure trove of findings and new knowledge into new or as we discussed, repurposed therapies?
Yeah, the real challenge is, from now looking at your genome, we've got 10,000 changes. But there are 10 new drugs, 10 old drugs, And so how do we find which of the 10,000 changes actually are linked to who will respond to this drug or not? And so for me, the key challenge is this translation phase. Can we run the right clinical trials,
mm-hmm.
That will allow us to objectively determine which of the 10,000 changes are really the important one or two, or it's probably the important 10 to 20 that are really going to drive drug selection and benefit for these patients, right? So, you know, using our knowledge of biology and genetics, we can look at this, say, you know, again, arbitrary number of 10,000,
mm-hmm.
and kind of go, well, I think these 100 are probably the ones we should look at. And then you take those 100 into these clinical trials for the thorough evaluation.
I see.
And then hopefully you do the trial, you come out at the end and you go, oh, it's these five.
Now we know.
Right? Now we know, right?
Well, I understand that part of what came out of this recent study was some new thinking about Herceptin.
Some new thinking about Herceptin, right? So that is a drug for which there's already a biomarker or a marker, shall we say, which
sure.
is mm-hmm. the high expression of the HER2 protein,
mm-hmm.
or the actually what we see is in a tumor, you get extra copies of it.
Okay.
10, 20, sometimes 50 copies of the gene when you should have two,
mm-hmm.
right? And
that's bad juju when that happens.
That's bad, right? And then you, from a genetic perspective, you kind of go, oh, that's an obvious signal, right? And
sure.
so from decades of research, we now have a drug that targets that. But if you sort of look at clinical trials that have that drug in people with the target, they don't all respond, right? Maybe 50, 60% of them respond. So mm-hmm. there's still, even when you have the target, there's still a heterogeneity of response. Why is that?
Mm-hmm.
So in the TCGA paper here, we actually looked at just those patients who were called HER2 positive and then did our multi-platform genomic analysis. And what you could see is there's at least two groups there. And actually in this TCGA paper, this is the first one where we had protein data. Right. And so, you know, protein's really the ultimate readout because the proteins actually do the functions of the cell. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what we could see was that you had the HER2 protein, but we could also detect an activated form of it, which is likely sending the growth promoting signal. And that actually it wasn't just HER2. It was one of its family members, also called EGFR, also called HER1, right,
mm-hmm.
Was right there with it. And it, too, was also sending a signal.
Okay.
And in one group, both of those two proteins was high and looked to be activated. In the other group, the protein was much lower and it looked to be less activated. So it was kind of...
And did that differentiate the response?
We didn't do this on a study which had response to this drug.
Okay.
Right? So we couldn't answer that question from the TCGA study. We're absolutely evaluating that in some existing studies as we speak because it's an obvious one, right? It
sure.
looks like one group's signaling and the other one's not,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You would think that's going to predict response. Well, you know.
We'll see.
Let's test it.
Sure.
Right? A lot of these things sound good, but you got to do the test to make sure.
Well, Chuck, I want to ask you, and some of those findings are just so exciting, and it's going to be so interesting to see the outcome of that particular study you just mentioned as a follow-up. So do you feel like we're on the brink of a new era in which most cancers will be actually well-treatable? You know, kind of the outlook of the disease changing to being considered more of a chronic condition, similar to the trajectory we saw with HIV/AIDS, or am I being too optimistic about that, or too simplistic?
I share your optimism, and I think we are on the brink of that. it does take time though, right? I mean, and mm-hmm. and there will be some patients for which, you know, we have no options still.
Sure.
Now, keep in mind that as important as is our ability to scan your genome is the development of effective drugs,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, what we can actually see right now is the implication of many of the cancer genomics is that, oh, we need to target protein X. And then what you go and you go look in the clinic and you go, oh, wow, there are drugs to protein X in development, right? Not mm-hmm. yet approved for anything.
Sure.
And then they're
which
actually...
That's why people are so encouraged, cancer patients are right. so encouraged to engage in these clinical trials.
Oh, so I let me only encourage patients to enter clinical trials for a number of reasons, right? First of all, they're going to get the best standard of care because mm-hmm. the clinical trial is basically the standard of the best that we know plus what we think is the next, what is going to be best, right? And then clinical trials is where we objectively figure out whether the new drug is actually helping, right? And so... We have a lot of drug development to be done, but, you know, the pharmaceutical company, I think, has many, many exciting new compounds that are being developed. And so as we test the new compounds and test the new biomarkers, I'm sure there are going to be new partners that come out and it's going to make general overall improvements. Now, whether we get to the stage where all cancers are a chronic disease, that might be a little optimistic, I think. I think we'll make many more a chronic disease, but there's still some that are still so aggressive, and we still don't know the bullet for those yet, but we're working at it. And actually, I think the next phase for some of our discovery projects are to move into those very incurable tumors,
mm-hmm.
You know, stage four patients with metastatic disease in multiple sites of the body. And we're actually doing that here at UNC, right? We're getting those samples. We're sequencing their genomes. You know, they're clearly have something really wrong with them
sure. In
those tumors. And I think studying them is going to be really important.
Absolutely. Well, Chuck, there's really a palpable sense of excitement here, you know, not just in what you've been saying, but in the research I did to prepare for the interview. It seems like everybody in the field is really feeling like things are really moving forward very quickly, and that there truly is a profound sense of hope for the future, perhaps even the near future.
I would agree. I think this is, you know, as I said earlier, this is the greatest time to be a geneticist or genomicist. The tools are amazing. The data is amazing. It's also, I think, a great time to be involved in clinical research and development, right? Because, you know, the tools to categorize patients are better than ever. We have more therapeutic options, more being developed. And so, you know, the stage is set to really marry the new findings with the new therapeutics and to continue to make improvements in cancer care.
It's going to be really interesting to watch that development, even just over the next, you know, 5 years or so, to see where things go.
Yeah, of course, wish it goes faster than it does. But
Well, Chuck, all that being said, what do you see as the major gaps in knowledge that still face the field?
You know, we still need better understanding of what I'll call the, you know, signaling pathways,
mm-hmm.
right? So, you know, to put this in a lay perspective, you know, cells sense the environment and send signals through a complex set of steps from the outside to the inside, and then once in the inside, it changes and sends another signal back out. We have a rudimentary understanding of the steps coming in and the steps going out. And then what we have even less of an understanding is, you know, we have one pathway actually, there's 10 pathways. And they talk to each other in ways which we really poorly understand. And that's where I think the great is the next challenge in the laboratory, right? And we're actually striving to develop computational or computer-based models of these signaling pathways,
mm-hmm.
so that we can better understand them and actually can we predict how they will behave, right? If we can do that, then that would be a huge, you know, biomarker or marker advancement because, you know, today we pretty much go, wow, you've, like HER2, oh, you've got the target, I'm going to give you the drug. I mean, then that's pretty simplistic and it's only going to work for so much more, right?
Sure.
What we want to be able to say is, oh, I've looked at your tumor and this pathway is gone askew. And that means I can give you X, Y, or Z, depending on a few other features. I now know what those other features are to look at. And so that means I should give you X, not, you know, one of three options, right? Which is sort of today you're kind of left at one of three options. We don't know which are better in part. And we don't know how the cell is quite wired yet. So I think by studying the interconnectedness of the pathways,
mm-hmm.
and then by developing predictive computer-based models of this, that will be, that's the gap.
Sure. But there are lots of people working hard on
There are lots of people working hard on that. And that's where, you know, the development of bioinformatics and informatics and computer-based analysis of genomics and genetics and proteomics data is
mm-hmm.
is about as important as the techniques themselves.
Absolutely.
Right? And so, you know, UNC is a leader in this. We need more students and more people trained in mathematics and biology because this is the next frontier, right? And this is where, you know, if, again, if we could make these predictive models, wow, we'd be able to predict so many more things, right?
And it's interesting you mention that because in a few weeks, and I'll just send people to the website, radioinvivo.net, to check out the upcoming schedule. My guest is going to be one of your colleagues from UNC in bioinformatics to delve into many of those issues you just talked about. It is a fascinating field and certainly increasing in importance.
Yep.
And I often tell young people I run across, from a lay perspective at least, you know, bioinformatics, young man, that is that is your ticket if you want to have a career these days.
I would completely agree.
So Chuck, where is the research in your particular lab headed from here? You've just had this major achievement. What's next for the Peru lab?
Well, I kind of hinted at a couple of them, right? So, you know, number one is we're trying to build these predictive computer-based models, right, of signaling pathways so that we can really understand how the wiring goes wrong and then how we can fix it.
Mm-hmm.
We're also studying metastatic disease, right? This, because that is what kills breast cancer patients, right? Almost no patient dies of their primary tumor. They die when it spreads to their liver, their lungs.
Sure.
And so we're studying those actual tumors. And then sort of the third emphasis is we're doing both of these things by studying actual human specimens, but we also have genetically engineered mouse models that develop mouse breast cancers or mouse mammary cancers.
Mm-hmm.
And those are quite exciting because those allow you to do real experiments, right? We can't do experiments in human beings.
Sure.
And
the mouse models have gotten much more sophisticated.
And the mouse models are allow you to do precise genetics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we engineer them to have certain genes or to not have certain genes. We can then look at the phenotype of the tumor, and then we, in essence, are sort of do the experiments we'd like to do in humans, right? We say, well, you have this genetic lesion. That means I think you should get this drug. Well, now you can do it.
Sure.
And see if it works,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the mouse models are what I call the preclinical testing ground the immediate step before you then test it in humans, right? You have to be, obviously, before you do any test in humans, which is called a clinical trial,
right?
Mm-hmm. You better be sure that this thing is acting the way you think it is, right? And so you need the complex organism, like a mouse, mm-hmm. or a mammal, right, to do the testing.
Sure.
Also in part because of, you know, what we'll call the microenvironment, right? A tumor just doesn't sit there by itself. It's interacting with normal tissues. It's interacting with your immune system. You just can't mimic that in a tissue culture dish.
Sure. Sure.
Right. So there's sort of this stepwise process of, you know, studying it in a dish. Then you just, there's no substitute for a complex mammalian system. And then it goes to people.
That's a very interesting process. Well, Chuck, I'm always curious. How did you individually become interested in this particular field and end up specializing in molecular oncology and breast cancer genetics?
Well, you know, I actually got in it sort of from the genomics perspective. You know, many years ago when I had to choose my postdoc, was the, you know, advent of what were called DNA microarrays at the time, which was the first technique for looking at genome-wide gene expression patterns.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got attracted to that technology, and then I also got attracted to applying this technology to cancer, because we knew there were just many, many changes occurring in tumors, but we didn't know, you know, what most of them were. And previously we had to go one gene at a time. Well, now you can go 20,000 genes at a time. And then at the same time, we also knew breast cancer was a heterogeneous disease and had many different types by visual inspection. And so we sort of assumed there would be many types by genomic inspection, and mm-hmm. we were right. So I think that, that's what got me started in looking at cancers, and in particular looking at breast cancers.
I see. Well, I read that you consider yourself to be a translational, and you've already kind of touched on this, but a translational researcher, in that you're active in both basic science and clinical research.
Yes.
Would you kind of elaborate on that concept?
You know, so I run a laboratory. Right. Mm-hmm. And do basic science research, with graduate students and, you know, postdocs in the lab. But the translational phase, right, you want to make your findings have an impact on cancer patient care. Again, this happens in clinical trial research. So over the years, I've become a member of basically two different clinical trial groups, which are mostly oncologists, but they have, you know, people like myself who have the basic research knowledge, and they have people who are, you know, statisticians.
Mm-hmm.
And we all get together at a table and talk about which trials to design and which drugs to evaluate and which biomarkers to test. And then we get money from the government and from some of the pharmaceutical industries to run the trials. I'm very much quite excited to be part of these clinical trials groups, because that's where, you know, that's where the rubber hits the road, right?
Sure.
That's where you make changes and improvements to clinical cancer care. So you got to be at the clinical trials table if you really want to make an impact.
So you're kind of getting the best of both worlds, really.
I'm getting the best of both worlds, right? Well, keeps me busy.
I can imagine.
I have still two whole sets of meetings to go to, right?
Indeed. We will certainly keep an eye on what you're up to, Chuck, with all of this. And, in maybe a couple of years down the road, we'll have you back and see how things have progressed from today. But it's very exciting what you and your group are up to, and tremendously important. And I want to thank you for being my guest on Radio In Vivo.
Been my pleasure.
We've got some great guests lined up in the coming weeks here on Radio In Vivo. You can check the website, radioinvivo.net, for our lineup of upcoming shows. We are on Facebook, so we invite you to become a fan and stay up to date. And join us again next time for Radio In Vivo, your link to the Triangle Science community, right here on volunteer-powered WCOM-FM Carborough and Chapel Hill. And if you enjoy the program, we do ask that you please make an effort to support this radio station by volunteering, contributing, or underwriting our programming. We are actively seeking new partners to underwrite our shows, so you can go to the website and find out more about our 50 by 100 campaign. So now be sure to stay tuned for one of our most popular shows on the WCOM schedule, The Courage Cocktail with Leanne McClymont. Catch you next time. Thanks for listening.
And composing by pressing down a special key and place a little melody.